I believe there are two ways to approach our lives. One is looking at it as a series of norms we have to live into and objectives we have to achieve. This view is full of expectations, pressures, bias, and systemic dynamics that continuously need to be overcome. The other is to look at life as a series of choices we make and goals we set for ourselves, a life that is full of agency, growth, and opportunity. Welcome to Live Stoked and Lead Stoked, where we explore both life and work from that latter perspective. I'm your host, Sarah Bettman, coach, consultant, and speaker. More importantly, I'm a fellow traveler on the path towards living my own stoked life, and I'm passionate about helping others do the same. Let's jump into this exploration of life and work and what it means to live and lead stoked.
Okay, we are here. I'm very excited to have Dr. Stephanie Kirkland with us. Thank you to all our listeners who are joining and listening to us. I'm sure you will find that Dr. Stephanie is as amazing in her thoughts and ideas based on a research, which we're going to talk about, totally aligned with the concept of Live Stoked. So welcome, Dr. Stephanie. Glad to have you here.
I am excited to be here.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to start with the first question. I already teed it up for you. What does it mean to you to live stoked? And recognizing that's my word for it, do you have a different word for it?
Well, based on, you know, our conversation about what it means to you and, you know, life on my terms, agency, choice, I think it perfectly means my conversation of identity and having an identity-centered life, meaning that I put myself in the forefront of how I shape, how I interact with the world. And that is really the fundamental foundation for how I engage with different aspects of my life, whether it's personal, professional, spiritual, relational, physical, I am at the forefront of that conversation and what that looks like.
And that's novel. That's different, right? And especially as women, and I don't want to stereotype women, but I feel like we as women do this. We put everyone else in front of us versus prioritizing our identity first. So I'd love for you to share a little bit more about that. I think the other thing that's important that will probably come in this answer is, you know, I come from coaching and training from my observations, but you come from research and you've done a lot of work around this that has you come to your beliefs. So if that gets woven into your answer about kind of how this is novel and different, I'd love to hear more about that because that is something you bring that's different to the conversation than a lot of coaches and people who work in the space.
Yes. So when we, you know, really talk about us as women and what actually happens culturally or in a societal framework, what we have to actually confess to is that we are groomed into roles and responsibilities that are reflective, or what we're taught are reflective of our positions, right? And how we show up in spaces. And so my conversation and context is we first have to do the identity work. That sets the foundation for actually how I show up in roles and responsibilities. So it's not I'm not throwing away that roles and responsibilities are a part of my narrative. What I'm saying is the foundation of who I am as a unique individual needs to set the tone for how I show up in those roles and responsibilities. And I don't allow cultural or societal norms to regulate for me or to set the tone for me as to what that looks like for me. So I use the example all the time. I say, my name is Stephanie, and I have the roles and responsibilities of a wife. My name is Stephanie. I am Stephanie, and I have the roles and responsibilities of an entrepreneur. So I am acknowledging that I am first, but who I am and the uniqueness of who I am and how I show up then sets the tone for how I show up in the roles and responsibilities that I walk out. So the roles become pathways, not identifiers. And I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, and it's so important. And for those of you who've listened to my first episode, I've told my burnout story where I let those roles and identities outside of me as a firefighter paramedic. It was so compelling. It was a series of 2 years and actually a continuous process of me figuring out who I am, what I'm about, and frankly, being able to claim certain parts of me. Like, this is just who I am, right?
Yes.
How does someone navigate it? Because we're both speaking here as people who get this. But I didn't get it. If you were talking to myself, you know, from 10, 20, I don't even know how many years ago, and I was putting all those identities in front of me, and I love what you're saying, but I have no idea how to get there. Mm-hmm. How do you get started?
Well, that's really what my new book is about. It's called, it's called Identity, 12 Lessons on Unapologetically Owning Your Uniqueness in a World That Doesn't See It as Normal. So, so three of the lessons that I have been talking about, because a conversation that I'm having in conferences and organizations, podcasts like this, is this conversation about how do I leverage my uniqueness for success, right? Yeah. And so one of those things and one of those lessons that we can help support people is the realization that you're the gift, right? I am the gift. It's not anything that goes on around me that perpetuates an understanding of me. No, it's me that's the gift. And then my beliefs, my values, my perspective, my traumas, my healing, my spiritual context, all of those things are woven together inside of who I am, right? Into the just the fabric of my being. And who that is, all of those pieces, is now being expressed forward, right? So it could be simple as just starting with one. Okay, so what are my beliefs? Just an exercise of self-awareness, right? That metacognition, thinking about what I'm thinking about, because, you know, I love the brain stuff. So we start processing. Why did I say that? Why did I do that? Where did that come from? And then asking yourself the question, do I want to keep it? And just taking the opportunity as women, I know, slow down enough to ask the questions. Why did I do that? Why did I say that? Where did that come from? Do I want to keep it? And I think that's the perfect start to this understanding of self-awareness and really looking inside of yourself to see why you're showing up the way that you are.
Well, I can't help but have a reaction because, I mean, I obviously love your work. I've read a couple of your other books and they're wonderful. So I'm kind of shocked by the reaction is, but can I? Like, I almost want permission to be able to even ask those questions. Mm-hmm. You're nodding. So I imagine this concept of like permission comes up a lot. How do you navigate that?
Well, we navigate it by then asking the question, why do you need permission? Where did that come from? Mm-hmm. Why did you think that? Why did you say that? And is that where you want to stay? I think we sometimes push away from the hard questions or we push away from the hard notions like, we don't want to say, I feel selfish doing that, or I feel that something is wrong with that. Because when we don't voice those things, we miss out on the opportunity to make a different decision. So there's nothing wrong with saying, I feel funny about saying, I think I need permission for that. But now, why do you feel that you need permission? Where did that understanding come from? And now make an intentional choice to think something different. Replace what is keeping you out of your next or keeping you out of building your capacity for what you know is for you in a bigger way. Ask the questions, ask yourself the hard questions, and then what is the response that you want in order to shift that narrative?
Yeah, and I think that last question you asked, like, is this what I want? I think that's an important, it's like, I always say I love coaching because it's like, okay, it's a forward-looking process and modality, unlike therapy, which goes backwards. It's like, okay, you screwed up your life. Now, what do you want to do with it? For me, that tone of conversation makes sense to me. It's like, let's deal with reality. And yes, I feel like I need permission. Do I want something different? Yes. And that almost cracks the door open. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've been talking about women, and I know this is true for men. The force of it is different, obviously, and the impact. So for those of you who are listening, you're men, Stephanie, though she works with women, and we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about the work you do, these concepts are really relevant to men, masculinity, and some of these identities that are put on men as well. So I just want to be clear, this conversation is not necessarily just women. We all know men that struggle with the same thing and look for the permission because they're going against maybe the models they saw in their father, in their families, yes, or in their culture. But before we get into that, I would love to know, how did you come to this work?
I came to this work through my own journey of asking those questions. I came to this work by having all of these roles and responsibilities in my life, you know, mother, wife, choir member, entrepreneur, mentoring women in the community. And I paused and I'm like, everybody is satisfied with how I'm showing up in spaces. Everybody's getting what they want, but I don't think I've tapped into purpose or why I'm supposed to be in the earth the way that I'm showing up. And it wasn't that I was not good at what I was doing, because we, as you know, with the coaching that we do, we know executive C-suite CEOs who are skilled at what they do, but still are asking the question, who am I? Why am I doing this? And what does this mean for me? And that's what I was doing. And so as I began to kind of just deal with that, understanding and giving myself permission that it was all right for this not to be the narrative, because my challenge was, okay, Stephanie, you've been living out this script, and all of these people who are connected to you are connected through this script. How are you going to make a different decision and not consider that selfish? And then I had to say, well, you know what's really selfish for me to keep living like this with these people who are connected to me, who I believe are connected to me because of the impact that I'm supposed to make in their lives, and me not find out who I am or who the greatest expression of myself is, and for me not to take the time to remove these scripts off of me and then make a decision about what I believe. What are my values? You know, what do I think about that? How do I want to show up? Where are my boundaries? What am I going to do with these narratives? And that's how my journey began. And as I began to answer those questions in my life, I started teaching them to people. And as I started, you know, teaching and sharing and just seeing the effect on people's lives, I started going back to school. And I remember in my master's program, a professor was teaching on individual psychology. And as he was teaching, I was sitting there with my mouth open, like, he's teaching my class. He's actually teaching my program. And I literally had to stop the class. I'm like, y'all, I am so sorry. But this man is teaching my class. This man from the 1800s is thinking like me. You need to tell me who this man is, you know? And so, you know, I was like, oh my God, this is research-based. This is not just my journey. This is not just my story. There's research behind this. You know what I'm saying? So it was like, the class was like, go ahead. And I was just asking all kinds. I mean, the philosophies he was using, the theories. I'm like, that's my program. That is what I'm teaching people. And so the pieces just started coming together. My lived experience and the research started to merge, and it built out into this identity-centered leadership conversation that I'm having and that I created in order to support people in their growth.
Yeah, I love that. I was just in a recent workshop and they said, rarely any of our content is something new and novel. Mm-hmm. Either we're refreshing it for a time, you know, what was relevant back then when he did that research to what the way you're packaging it, or maybe how you interpret it, whatever it is. And I love that story about, you know, here's this guy from 1800s teaching your class. I've certainly had those things. And it's really been helpful to go to the root, because I also think when I talk about hard topics, which, you know, I know you do too, it's like, yes, there's a thought leader way smarter than me who does this work that I'm borrowing just this small concept of, for you to get a bigger picture, you can go back to the source, mm-hmm, and dig as deep as you want. Because how many times have you heard something like, well, I want to learn more. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you just got to pick up the phone and talk to the speaker, where the truth of the matter is you can find the source. But it's something else struck me. And this is different than my story, I think, because we actually haven't talked about this.
Okay.
I had to burn out body, mind, and spirit. And you think of people like Glennon Doyle. Her first book was a burnout, body, mind, and spirit. The world had to collapse, lying on the floor. You know, mine was sitting in the car, these crux moments. You didn't have that. You had.
You did.
Okay.
I did.
Would you be willing to share some of that?
Sure. But it was after this conversation, like I said earlier, about doing all of these things for everybody, and I wasn't getting fulfilled from it. And I just kept doing the routine, right? I kept doing what I knew to do because I didn't know to do something else. And if, as you read in my book, you'll see the second part of my story, which is that first part. But I literally went to my husband and says, I can no longer do the work that I'm doing for you because I just need to stop everything and decide what this looks like for me. And he was like, please go do what you got to do. I literally gave up any positions, any type of work that I was doing for other people. I stopped everything because I knew in the inside of me that the path that I was going on was not what I felt called in my spirit, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. I felt myself and I could see myself differently than what I was living out. And I just felt that I couldn't continue on this path in order to get to her. And so, that burnout was a part of my story as well.
Yeah. Is there a way, and I think there is, otherwise I wouldn't do the work I do. Is there a way or a way you look at this that, I call it, why wait for the heart attack, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I find myself being protective of people that you don't have to reach burnout to get these wise lessons. But then there's always this tension of, but that hitting bottom, whatever that bottom is the place where an incredible learning can happen. So, mm-hmm. you know, like I say, don't wait for the heart attack. And what that metaphor means is we all know the call. Mm-hmm. We get that call and we'll drop everything. I'll politely say, you know, Stephanie, it's lovely to have you here, but I need to go deal with whatever it is. We all know that. Right. And life will go on. How do you help your learners, the people you coach and the people you work with, your clients, not have to hit that bottom, but still get the depth and understanding to live that life that is an identity first, is fulfilled, and that using my metaphor, filling your tank versus just continuously draining it?
I think it's just a matter of people being sensitive enough to know that what they're feeling, that angst that they're feeling, is their spirit, soul, and body telling them that they need to realign in some kind of way. So it's really helping people to do that practice of self-awareness, giving people language and capacity. I think the biggest challenge for people and for us and why we hit the bottom is because we didn't have the capacity or the language to describe or have a conversation about what we were experiencing so that we could move forward away from the angst or the resistance or the concern, because we had those feelings way before we burn out. But nobody didn't give us the ability to have language and conversation around that so that we could process and think in a different way other than our lived experience in the moment, right? And so that was really one of the crux of me doing the book, is to give people language, give people capacity, give people permission to think about themselves first so that they won't have to go through that.
Yeah, I know for me, it was like I was afraid to look. I'm afraid to look at, say, my marriage because I'm afraid of what I might find and what it means. And I like how you say that. I didn't feel like I had the tools to talk about it. And it was like, if I look, it ends. I don't mm-hmm. want to look at my dissatisfaction with my job because it means I have to leave. And I don't have the capacity to change my life like that. But the truth of the matter is, it's the not looking that causes us to catastrophize. When in fact, when we look, we might actually find, and I was using this example with a client yesterday, I've looked at all sorts of jobs. I continuously evaluate my job and I come right back to where I am, but just with a new kind of understanding of what I need in my job, maybe conversations I'm not having. Mm-hmm. Same with relationship. I'm much more mature in my current marriage versus my practice marriage. Right. But this idea of, you know, bringing up things early, because if I'm looking at it thinking it needs to end, it's not too late. But mm-hmm. I already missed a few opportunities to talk about that. And I think that's an interesting perspective you bring about. For me, I always said I was just afraid to look. But had I had the language, had I had, you know, permission, that word comes up, to explore, but a construct, because mm-hmm. it felt so overwhelming and scary that I didn't look head in the ground until, you know, life bonked me on the head and said, you got to look.
Yeah. And if you think about that, that is a capacity issue. It's not that you did not want to do something different. It's not that you did not want better. But based on who you were in that moment and what your lived experience gave you, what your journey through your life gave you the understanding for, you couldn't make a different decision. And I think that's why there is power in language, capacity, relationships, growing, because it gives us more for our brains to work with to expand how we can engage with the conversations in a different way. And again, you know, that's the premise of the book. Let me give you these pillars. Let me give you these lessons to expand your capacity so that as you process, as you show up as yourself, now you have more knowledge to support whatever directive you want to go in. And I do that in executive coaching, right? Yeah. Sometimes it's not about just sitting there and asking questions. When you recognize it's a capacity issue, a lot of the executive coaching I'm doing is not that they don't have the ability to understand and make decisions. We know that's not the case because we believe as coaches, your answer's on the inside of you. But yeah. If you don't have the knowledge, language, and capacity to expand your thinking, to have a bigger conversation with yourself, then me just asking you questions does not benefit you. And that's why I've taken and coined that conversation in with my doctorate of education. It centers around a conversation of instructional coaching, right? Yeah. That I help you to increase your capacity so that you can make decisions when you go into your life and work. And I think that's important.
You know, it's funny, I landed there as well. I was going after the MCC credential from the ICF, and I found myself being tempted to game the system because where I've landed is, I call it a consultative coach.
Right.
And, you know, I started in wellness, and it was like, if you don't know what a protein is, you're not going to find it from the universe, right? I need to explain what a protein is, the benefits of it. But the coaching stance is then you get to decide what to do with it. Right.
Correct.
And so I can insert, and sometimes inserting stories of either my own or other clients validates enough that it's like, oh, and it just, you see the shoulders relax. And it's like, okay, I'm not the only one. And now they have the space to explore. Mm-hmm. And so I've opted not to go for my MCC because I realized because that version of coaching is just a question asking model. Mm-hmm. I realized I'd be misrepresenting myself. And I do think for the clients I work with, executives and such, sometimes you have to give them something to react to or a construct to hang their knowledge because mm-hmm. the personal development work sometimes is so different. The spreadsheets or the analytics or whatever they're used to working in the corporate space, we're stretching them into a different emotional intelligence space, a different mm-hmm. space that needs something. So I appreciate you saying that. For me personally, it's been a struggle talking about the identity of coach, right? Mm-hmm. Identity of consultant. There are great debates of what that is. You mentioned your doctorate. So if you notice, we have Dr. Stephanie Kirkland here. We get to call her a doctor. And you've done some amazing, brilliant research, which actually takes this concept and narrows it. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your research and how what your premise was and what you learned in the experience and now what where that takes you?
The premise of my doctoral work is centered again back to identity, right? Back to issues of leadership because my concentration is in organizational leadership. And as we both know, the primary leadership models and norms that are used are centered on Anglo-heterosexual males. And it is used for everyone with regards to what leadership is, what power is, how we show up in spaces. And as an African-American woman, as a Black woman, I know those models did not work or do not work for me. And the women who were coming into my space, it did not work for them.
And so, was career limiting, right?
Very.
Or ultimately unsafe.
Very, very unsafe. Yeah. And so the question began as I was, you know, just kind of bantering back and forth with the team that we have. And I was like, I want to have this conversation about how do we, and the language came up, decenter. Because mm-hmm. it's not that we want to eradicate Anglo males and how they show up in their own way of showing up in spaces. But now how do we decenter? And the word was prototypical leadership norms, right? So how do we decenter these leadership models and ways of showing up? And then how do we now begin to normalize African-American women's leadership? And I use the word modality, how they show up in dominant culture spaces. So we're decentering and we're normalizing. And so that became the premise of my work. And so I started going around to women, Black women who were in executive spaces, and I began asking them questions around, okay, there wasn't diversity, equity, and inclusion really when you was around. So how are you successful? What did you do? What was the show up for you? And everybody said the same thing, Sarah. I was who I was, no matter what. I had a sense. The language I ended up with is a sense of self, right?
Yeah.
I knew my beliefs, my values, my boundaries, how I wanted to show up, what that meant. And the really powerful part was, and I was willing to accept the consequences for it. Oh, yeah. That was the key right there, right?
And it's so counter to some of the language about needing to code switch. Now, I understand code switching is a safety element and it's a way of getting along, but your research actually showed that success was different. It wasn't in code switching.
No one ever said anything about code switching. None of the women that I researched ever even addressed code switching. And when I do have clients who are telling me, you know, that they're dealing with that or they have to become different people, they're miserable. Because they are, again, not feeling like they have the safety is the word that you used, or the ability, or that the environment is even available to allowing them to be different than what the organization has deemed to be a leadership model or a leadership norm. And again, that goes back to the consequence, right?
Right.
You have to decide, is this environment for you? Right. Carolyn Wanga says it beautifully. Right. If you can't be you, then you need to do something else. Even if it means leaving where you are, you understanding who you are and walking as your authentic self needs to be a primary factor, because I truly believe that we are purpose. I never thought of purpose as being outside of me. To me, purpose is me being the greatest expression of myself. The intertwining of everything that makes me who I am, the wisdom that is now derived from that, the perspective, you know, my leaning, my gifts and talents intertwined to make me who I am is necessary. And it is who I am that is needed for where I show up, for who I impact and what that looks like, whether they want it or not, right? It goes back to that need or want, because we're groomed to do what people want. We're not necessarily groomed to be what people need, because this is who I am. And I'm not talking about being nasty and rude and disrespectful. I'm not talking about any of that. But I'm talking about showing up as my greatest self and allowing other people to make a decision if that is for them, because I'm settled that it's for me. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And honestly, part of my burnout story, you know, I mentioned I started as a wellness coach, and that was such a gift, because what I realized is that I've defined in my work twisting versus flexing. Mm-hmm. And the twisting is important, because think of it wringing out your well-being. So when I was a firefighter, I really hid that I was a woman. And I tell this story, I think in episode 2, of this idea of, like, if you see me, I look like a woman. I can't hide that, but I wouldn't accept help. And I was masculine and I was trying to twist who I was. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until years later that I met a battalion chief for a large city fire department. And she was as feminine as you could be. Her crew would go miles for her. I'm like, if I had seen you in the workplace, I probably would have done things different. And the consequence, and probably the root of why I do my work, is when you're twisting, you're wringing out your well-being, which causes that physiological burnout, right? Oh, yeah. You're not tapping into that wellspring of who you are. And so then I differentiate, because I get a lot of questions, and I'm sure you get this, of, well, what if the company needs me to show up a different way? And I love that you bring Carolyn Wanga up. Well, then it's flexing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to show up different camping with my friends and family than I will at an executive board retreat, right?
But it's all me, right?
And that's the key, is being able to flex in those different environments. They fill my tank in different ways. Facilitating an incredible discussion with the board fills my tank in ways that sitting, camping, enjoying nature would never will, and vice versa. But it is all of me. And I think that, you know, when we get these questions of, well, they say I can't show up this way or I can't show up this way, it comes to, that's okay. Are you okay with flexing? Because we were talking about tattoos on a call yesterday. And it's like, some environments care about tattoos. And we could debate till the cows come home whether that's right or not. But the bottom line is, if you go in that environment, they care about tattoos and you have tattoos, you may choose to cover them and you're totally okay with it because it's your personal thing and you could care less what work. Or you might say that you're offended. That's on you. And that's that choice that Carolyn Wanga is talking about, that then it's not the right environment for you. And I think sometimes we get stuck thinking we want to change the environment or all spaces we should fit in and be able to impact. And I use the example Hobby Lobby. Mm-hmm. Hobby Lobby is very clear where they stand about LGBTQ. It's right. anti-LGBTQ, but at least they're in integrity. So it would be remiss if any one of us who are allies or LGBTQ go work there and expect them to be something different. Mm-hmm. And it starts with us. And I think my long thing is the consequence is our well-being and the work starts with us so that we can be grounded in ourselves and then choose. I choose to flex in environments that maybe aren't the fullest expression of me, but I love them because I get something else out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree. And that's one of the lessons in my book. It's about you, not them.
Yeah.
It starts with you. It doesn't start with them. And understanding where you are, what that looks like, and how you need to show up, I think is the primary thing, right? You know, especially when people are upfront about their narratives, then why go to be abused? Why go into that? I don't personally comprehend that. But the bottom line is, you have to be okay being you and understand that it is your gift that you are trying to impact with in spaces. And there is people who want that. There are people who want to grow with you, who want to hear your perspective and your lens. To me, those people are called to my light. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that I want to be around.
Yeah. Well, and for those of you listening, if you can see why I could talk to Dr. Stephanie for hours, because you embody this, right? Mm-hmm. Even just hearing you talk about this is my life's journey, right? Mm-hmm. And we're all in process, right? It's progress, not perfection.
But we're ever evolving.
Ever evolving. I love that. Yeah, absolutely. But the angst is real. So if any of you are listening and thinking that, that's nice. It sounds so simple, but it isn't. We know that it isn't. And that's why you've got your book, right? Mm-hmm. It is work. What are some of the things you do personally? Because you put yourself out there in a big way. You're speaking, you're coaching. You know, one of the reasons I love speaking with you is it inspires me to be a bit more confident in my voice and the things I bring out to the world. I know how much work. It's a little bit of a, okay, here we go. We're going to do this again today. What are some of the things that you do? You know this in the bones, but I also know you have practices and ways that keep you going forward for yourself. It's easy for us to talk about it. It's something else for us to do it for ourselves. What are the things you do to stay on track?
I have boundaries. I have boundaries about how I deal with people, how I deal with life, what I do on a day-to-day basis. I have boundaries around my schedule, what I will and will not do, what I need, and I know what I need, right? I think people have a misconception of what it means to be an introvert. I am an introvert, but we think that somebody who is an introvert doesn't like people. I love people. I love being around people. I love engaging, but people do drain me. Yeah. So I know my limits, right? Like for the conference that we do in November in Linkage, I tell Nicole, she's an extrovert, right?
Oh, yes.
And she's an extrovert. And so I tell her, okay, I'm going to talk to 6 people and then I'm going to the room. I'm good. And she's like, 7, you know? No, I don't.
And if you two, listeners, if you could see Stephanie and Nicole together, there is no better sight to see them together. They've been friends for a long time. And it's really funny because you two are absolutely like that. Nicole's like, yeah, but let's keep going. And I cannot, she's about to host an amazing event where we're going to be next week.
Yes.
And so I can't wait once when that dust settles to get her on here. And actually, maybe I need the two of you because the two of you is just some magic right there.
yes. And so we're like that, yeah.
How did you find those boundaries? I love that concept of boundaries. And I say it that way on purpose because I love the concept. The holding of them is something else entirely. And I got to be honest, I'm pretty damn messy about it.
Yeah. I hold them because I believe that it is necessary for me to be at my best. I think when we define why the boundaries are there, not just create them because it sounds good or that it looks like it will have a successful end, when your boundaries are a part of who you are, your boundaries are what supports you being able to do what you desire to do, you hold them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I have my boundaries in the morning. I wake up really, really early. I need my quiet time. I need to be by myself. You know what I'm saying? I like being in the house by myself. Those are mine. Those are my boundaries. I even have boundaries with my husband, right? We have narratives because he's an extrovert. So he just started working from home. Oh my God, the trauma in my life, right? And so, and he's an extrovert. And so he'll be in one part of the house and here he comes. He can't sit, but like 45 minutes, 30. He was like, Stephanie, how do you sit there? You've been there all day. Yes, I can sit here and work all day. He'll come and he'll kiss me or he'll bring me some kind of joke. And I'd be like, John, mm-mm. You gotta move. You're in this is my space. I've been by myself all this time and here you are, right? But he gets it because he understands that he has boundaries too, right? He has things that he needs that make him the best that he can be. And so to me, without boundaries, I cannot be who I'm supposed to be. It's that serious for me, right? Without me sharing, because to me, they're a part of my beliefs. They're a part of my value system. And I truly know beyond the shadow of the doubt, those boundaries help me be the greatest expression of myself. So they're non-negotiables.
Yeah. And I love that because I think I'm realizing I hold a lot more boundaries than I think I do. Like bedtime. I get up early, so I go to bed early. And I may do my crossword or read, but I don't stay up anymore. I used to stay up because I thought I should, or I might miss the party. And I choose not to. And that's for my well-being. I love that you're talking about your husband. So I travel a lot for work and my husband doesn't. And when I come back for trips, it's like vacation. He's so excited to hear all about it. In this conference that you're talking about in November, he's learned because I went to that fairly early in our relationship. He was so excited to hear about it. It's like, you don't talk to me about this. I will come to you when I'm ready to share what happened. And usually it's 3 days later, because even though I would say I'm right on the cusp of EI, I get my energy from people, but I'm really loving my alone time.
Right.
And we call it reentry now. It's like, mm-hmm. I need reentry.
Yes.
Even yesterday, I had an offsite with a new client and he was all excited to hear about it. I'm like, I'll come to you with it. And I'll tell you, he's just, I've been in this abyss as far as he's, other than our evening check-in, how's it going? He's dying to hear all about it. He's excited about it. I'm like, I am done.
I call it woosah. I got a woosah and then we can talk about it. I mean, even after I speak, I just need space. I've been talking to people. I've stood up there for whether it's an hour, 4 hours. You know what I'm saying? I just need space. I need to just be quiet and sit on the couch. And he gives me that. Yeah. And I think when you make them non-negotiables, the people who love you give you that because you give them the same courtesy for their boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I love that so much. So we could talk forever. And I've already committed to, you know, having everyone come back so we can keep going the conversations. But it's poor form to do 90-minute podcasts, I guess. And so with that, I would love to hear from you. And this could be from your research. But what are some of the things you're reading, watching, people you're following that are interesting? And again, they don't have to be all around work. It could be just I had someone talk about not Desperate Housewives, that was a generation ago. Real Housewives is her guilty pleasure. So this does not have to be serious at all. What are the things you're watching and listening to or spending your time on?
Right now, because I'm writing, I don't have a lot in my space. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, right now it would either be books that kind of prepared my thinking and my processing for what it is that I'm writing. But I try not to watch things that kind of give me information, if that makes sense, or to kind of skew my processing and how I want to engage with my book. So I end up watching stuff like Murder, She Wrote, Diagnosis Murder, you know, stuff from way back when, The Animals, you know, Critter Fixers, Dr. Pole. I mean, I watch nature and, you know, really, really lighthearted stuff, you know, so that it doesn't really kind of disrupt my thoughts and my flow. So I try not to watch anything too serious or too powerful. So that's my guilty pleasures right now. I'm a Murder, She Wrote, Diagnosis Murder. I love mysteries, CSI New York, you know, stuff that has a, you know what's going to happen at the end. Everything is kind of planned out. So I do those things just for the entertainment and just to give myself a break while I'm writing.
Oh my God, I had no idea. And I love that so much. Because I've known you. I mean, you were in your doctorate when we first met, and you have an intensity about you, a learner's mind, and a wisdom about you. I love that so much. It gives me so much permission that I can watch my cat videos online. But I mean, to be fair, we need that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
People say, don't scroll on the internet. You know, sometimes I just need to see, you know, be voyeuristic, see what's happening in the world.
Yes.
I don't spend too much time, but some of the things they say productivity people you shouldn't do, mm-hmm. I do it because it's neutral.
Yes.
Right. It doesn't add. Perfect it doesn't word. Drain my tank. It doesn't. I love. Doesn't influence some thought that I'm barely grasping at. So, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, that's
love
awesome.
It.
Any books or resources for a general audience? Because you're obviously going for a purpose. Any thought leader right now that you think would be that we could toss out to our listeners to say, you know, this is someone that I've been interested in.
Well, I've been, but the things that I'm reading now are very spicy. So like one book that I'm reading is called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Joy McGuy. And I'm reading this other book called Plantation Theory by John Graham. And then I have this other book called Black Women in White America. It's a historical context about how women are showing up in Black women. Right now it's Black feminist thought. So everything is kind of leaning towards this narrative and conversation of what's going on with identity and how people are showing up and what that looks like, other people's stories and narratives. So that's kind of where my mind is around my doctoral work and so forth, and pulling those narratives out. So that's why I'm saying, you know, they're spicy, but it really is helping to kind of shape my narrative around what I'm writing about and what that looks like.
Oh, I love that so much. And as a white woman reading some of this, it helps to, for me, I've taken away, I don't know if it was Plantation Theory, but something similar. I don't know the context of the book, so I don't want to mistake two concepts, but some of what's happening in our politics and out in the world and how things are expressing through the white identity and some of these theories. So I'm excited about some of these books because I read them as an understanding of, you know, the white side that needs to be seen and understood and shifted, because that's the place I play, right?
Yes.
How do we deconstruct some of this? How do we see what we cannot see in order to change it? So,
yeah, because like Plantation Theory is the second line is the Black professional struggle between freedom and security.
Yep.
So he brings that context of needing to work, but at the same time, the struggle of work in spaces that are not necessarily constructed or safe for you. Very fascinating.
And then how that plays out with the white, not the master, but the white, I'm forgetting the name, and this promise to the white, not the slave owner, but the, I'm forgetting the name, this promise of wealth, I've got you, and it just never happens. So there's a followership that happens under the plantation owner for white people to perpetuate the violence, to perpetuate the divisiveness for the sake of their own safety that can't be unwind unless you see it and understand it. Anyway, we'll save that podcast for another day because that's a whole other theoretical level that I love.
It is.
I loved our dinner that we had. We brought a colleague of mine and she just walked away saying that was the most amazing conversation. And we were just jawing on our normal topics. And
stuff. Right.
But because we're curious and readers, we just go to another place that we'll save the audience from for today.
Okay.
So where can people find you and when is your book coming out?
My book is coming out this spring. So we start doing a little pre-order launch in March. So we're looking at spring for the official show up and the tour and the engagement with the products. People can find me on LinkedIn at Dr. Stephanie M. Kirkland. You can find me on Facebook as Stephanie M. Kirkland, Instagram under Identity Dynamics and Dr. Stephanie M. Kirkland. My website is identitydynamics.net. So I look forward to connecting and engaging.
Yeah, we'll have all that in the show notes. And depending on where you're listening to this, we will make sure that we connect to the book, whether it's pre-order or if you're listening to this at a later date, you'll see it as a New York Times bestseller and Amazon bestseller. Let's just put that out into the universe.
I receive it.
Good. Well, I will read it quickly. I will put it on my 24 book list because I've loved so many of the other things you've written. I should share, talking about Dr. Stephanie's books. she brought her books to this conference we went to. They had a bookshop and she sold out of everything. And I think she's the only author that actually did. So just so you know, she writes some good shit out there. So
yeah, all six. I mean, they bought all six of them and all of them.
And I want to be clear, all six books, different books. She didn't bring six books that were sold. She brought hundreds of books that were six different books and all of those sold. So anyway, just a shout out that this is an author worth reading and I can't wait to read. And actually, maybe after the books come out, we'll have you come back. And, okay. And I can't wait to hear what the world has to say. I know it will be awesome. But thank you so much for your time. I love this discussion. And we'll keep going. We'll keep going. Have you come back. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening. If you have any questions, comments, please don't hesitate to rate the podcast. We're here for you. And part of how I'm building this content is, again, living stoked despite identities and roles put upon us, that life of agency, as you've heard from Dr. Stephanie, it's not always easy. It's not about always being happy, but it's about doing the work. So if you have any ideas around topics that we could share here, we'd love to hear it. So until next time, it's good to have you here and we'll talk soon. Thanks so much for joining us for Live Stoked, Lead Stoked. We know you're busy, so it means the world to me that you'd spend this time with us. If you're interested in digging deeper on the topics discussed today, be sure to check out the show notes for resources and links related to this episode. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button if you found this to be time well spent. Your support helps us immensely. Plus, consider leaving a review. They're like virtual high fives, and I appreciate every one of them. Finally, stay connected with us on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Feel free to shoot us a message or a question. Your stories and experiences enrich the community we're building here, and you never know, your question may end up on a monthly Ask Me Anything. So until next time, keep subscribing, keep reviewing, and keep living your most stoked life. We'll be back with more inspiration, stories, and insights. See you then.